So today is August 27, 2018. It's Monday. And in the room today at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, are Ed Shockley, S-H-O-C-K-L-E-Y, and Ed's son Greg, and I'm Tom Martin. And Ed had a chance to watch Ed Hudson. Had a chance to watch Ed Hudson and his son Ed build the Esmeralda 2 in Paso Robles, California. So, Ed, thank you so very, very much for being willing to come in. And Greg, thank you for making this all happen. What year were you born, Ed?
1932.
Where were you born?
Glendale Research Hospital.
Where was that?
Glendale, California.
Okay. Was that near Paso Robles? I'm pretty close.
No, that's actually it's just west of Pasadena, or west of San Marino.
So just west of here?
Yeah, west of here, 15 miles.
Okay. What were your parents doing here then?
My parents, we lived in probably Montrose, and my father was in construction, and he also worked for the CCCs as a Reserve Army officer.
This was during the Depression then?
Yes, this is during the Depression.
Okay.
Probably up through 35 he was doing that.
Okay.
My mother was a seamstress for whoever could use her expertise in sewing.
Okay.
In fact, that's how she paid for our Cocker Spaniel pet.
Oh.
The doctor wife had her make her dresses.
What was the name of your Cocker Spaniel?
Oh.
You weren't ready for that question, were you?
Nicky. And he was lost up the San Gabriel Canyon in with my dad fishing. And he got in the water and couldn't get out.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
gosh. But your dad liked to fish.
Oh, yes. He loved fly fishing.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Wonderful.
Pardon me?
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Huh.
And hiking.
Okay.
They would, in a day, they would ride the streetcar up to San Marino and get off of it at the end of the line and go up the hill to Mount Wilson and come out down to Montrose.
So make a loop out of it then? Or
yeah,
or
and you look at that mountain from 20 miles away, and that's awesome.
That's amazing. Wow. So did your mom and dad, did they take you out as a young man, a young boy, camping and fishing?
You know, the one camping trip that I really remember probably was 1937. My father took us up to a lodgepole in Sequoia, and he set up a tent in a campsite near the ranger station, and we were all set. We had all the food we needed for a while in a larder that you had put up in a tree. And so my sister, who's 4 years older than I, and myself and my mother were in the tent, and it was raining. And the tent leaked a little bit because we did not touch it. You touch the inside of a tent and it leaks.
Yeah.
And then my sister heard a noise, and she peeked out, and she says, "There's a bear in our larder."
No.
We'd forgotten to put it up in the tree. My mother grabbed the axe and she stormed out and she slammed the axe on the table and the bear ran off.
Oh my gosh.
So my mother wrote a telegram. Tent leaks, bear-rated larder, we're wet and want to come home. And my sister and I went down to the ranger station and he sent the telegram off. And like the next night, my father was up there and we went for a walk, and I remember I was five, and he was in uniform and I was walking right beside him, and I stayed right close to that to his boot.
Because there were bears out there.
There were bears there.
Oh my heavens.
So that was the extent of family camping. Although there was others, but building a lodge up at Lake Sequoia in summertime, volunteer help. That went up through 41, probably, okay. 1941. And this beautiful lodge for the Hanford YMCA.
Wow.
And it's all volunteer. And so we lived up there for the summer.
Nice. Did you like that?
Yeah. But that's the way it was. And, you know, it wasn't long after that. It was the Hudsons probably came to Paso Robles probably in 42, maybe.
How did you end up in Paso Robles? Because you're living here.
That's where, isn't it? By then, we were up there. My father went up to build a gym for the Paso Robles High School. And it was the last WPA project in the area.
Okay. What year would have that been?
Well, it would have been 1940.
Okay.
Because that's when the Paso Robles Inn burned.
Okay, so you would have been 12 in 1940. And,
no, I was
no,
8
I'm
in
sorry,
1940.
Yes, thank you. And did you all move up there, your mom and your sister
yeah,
and your
we
dad?
We all moved up there.
Okay.
So we were there and through my graduation of high school.
Okay.
And so we were there all through the war years. And
how did you meet then? What we should probably call Ed Jr.
Yeah, Ed Jr. Well, they bought what had been, I believe, the Clark drugstore, which was next to, I think it was next to the Mercantile in Paso Robles. And he was in my class. And we sort of buddied up. And we did, we were out in the country a lot, just walking, hiking, shooting. We both had 22 rifles of, probably by the time we were 12, before we were 12, actually.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And we'd just stick a box of ammo in our pocket and we'd go. But we never got in trouble with them. But we knew all the hills and valleys around Paso Robles. And Ed got into photography, and somewhere along the line he had a Leica camera, which was the epitome of cameras at the time. And it's sort of funny, but we used to tease him about his Mickey Mouse camera. And that goes back, that was in the 40s, and Mickey Mouse was a very popular item. So it's sort of amazing to me that we used it in the same manner that is, well, that's the Mickey Mouse thing, you know. We used it then as we do now.
as a term meaning cheap or goofy?
Yeah, we were. It was sort of, we were teasing him about this beautiful camera that he had. But he enjoyed photography. I think he did his own developing.
Okay.
And so that was a thrust in his life. I don't think shooting was a thrust in his life.
Okay.
But
did he stutter?
Ed did stutter.
Did he stutter when he was 10, when you first knew him?
Yes, he did. He stuttered most of the way. It didn't bother us. I stuttered some. Didn't study very much. I stuttered more than I studied, I think, but less than Ed. We spent a lot of time together.
Nice.
And they owned a home on the east side of the Salinas River, which divides Paso Robles, and there was a small settlement over there that they were, where they lived. And all he had to do was to get to work or to school. They would just drive down the hill across the bridge and then they'd be in town. And so that was the way it was.
Where did you guys live?
We lived, we rented the house for a short time and then we bought a house that was quite old in Paso Robles. And I believe it was, we bought it from the Bell family, that the father, I believe, was a blacksmith, and George Bell, who we bought it from, who had been born in the house, we would have bought it in late 40 or 41.
Okay.
And he was a plumber. So he probably developed the sanitation system in Paso Robles. But, and we enjoyed the house for quite a ways.
So that was in town and...
Yeah, it was in town.
To get to the Hudson's place, you'd have to go down across the river and then up the other side?
Right.
Okay.
And probably 2-3 miles away. But we lived on Oak Street, which was also known as Church Street, and one end, it ran dead into the high school.
Okay.
And the other schools were all around us. One time Ed and I were horsing around in our house and wound up sitting on this trumpet that I had and it bent it, so then I couldn't play it anymore. And we tried to straighten it and it didn't work, so I wound up buying a new trumpet, which was money at the time.
I was gonna say, if you didn't want to play the trumpet, it might have been an okay thing. But if you needed to play that trumpet, it was not an okay thing.
Well, I enjoyed it. I wasn't gifted at it, but I did enjoy it all the way through high school.
Nice.
Music was big. I don't think music was big for Ed. Ed was probably more studious than I. I don't remember him being in band. That meant he was, involved in photography, which he was a photographer for our annual. And although I don't remember him studying photography at all in college, we went to the same college for a year and then he transferred down to UCLA or USC, or, no, UCLA in geology.
Okay.
Where he graduated.
In geology?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a classmate went down there with him. So the two of them graduated together.
Oh, fun.
And by that time, I was down, before he graduated, I was down in the descent in Los Angeles area and talking with them, and they said, hey, we're going out on a field trip this next Saturday, why don't you come with us? And I'm fine. And so we went out and did some mapping, on geological mapping, in this area that had experienced some mining. And so that was an outdoor fun day. And they were probably juniors in college at the time. And so on the way home, there was a bunch there, maybe 10, 15 guys, all doing more or less the same thing. And we stopped at this roadhouse that would be on Highway 14. And most of them had beers. I may have had a beer too, and maybe a sandwich. Anyway, they were talking, and they were talking about what they had seen and experienced. And I thought, you know, they could have been a stranger listening to them. They might have been talking about the loveliness of a lady.
Oh my gosh.
And I said, these guys are crazy if they think that's so beautiful. And
they were so dedicated to it.
Yes, they were.
Huh.
And, but I never, I always remember that conversation style that they had.
Talking about slip and angle and the horn blends and the feldspar plagic clays, whatever they do.
Yeah. They were sold on it.
You know, Ed, what do you remember about Mr. and Mrs. Hudson?
I didn't have a lot to do with Mr. Hudson. I knew he was the drug story, and they... I believe they made their drugs. They compounded their drugs.
Okay.
Which doesn't often happen now.
Right.
I remember once Ed, my friend, and I wound up eating lunch at his home, and his mother cooked abalone. And it was like, you slice it very thin and go on a frying pan, 1, 2, 3, flip it over, 1, 2, 3, in the plate.
Wow.
And that was the one time I really remember eating abalone.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was good.
Nice.
Yeah. They're rather hard to find, but at that time they were a lot more visible along the California coast than they are now.
And Mrs. Hudson was Marion, I think. Was that her name?
Oh, no, I don't remember her name. But when I saw her in the picture that my son brought up out of the computer, she was small, diminutive, and both Eds were tall. And we had a lot of fun together.
Hmm.
And one time I was up there, and the Esmeralda was in the, I'm going to say it was just past the framing area. It had a double bottom of marine plywood, so that it had a lot of strength on the bottom. So it would have been probably 1 full inch thick on the bottom of an oak frame, and the sides were 1/2 inch thick. They didn't need, the boat wasn't going to land on the side, it might get deflected away on the side. And it had 3 sealed compartments. They were open on top, but they were, water would not translate between them. If water got into them, it wouldn't go from one to the other.
Okay. Let's back up for a minute. When did you first get an inkling that there was a boat being built at the Hudson home? And you must have asked your friend Ed about it. Ed, what's going down here?
Yeah.
How did that all come about?
Well, I think the Esmeralda 2 was the name of it. And I first remember seeing it when it was at least halfway. The bottom was done, the sides were, the frame was there, and they're getting ready to work on the sides or the tops. I'm not sure.
Okay, so it was well on its way when you first were over at the house.
And an interesting thing about it, it had a blunt nose that was probably 2 feet wide. And it was, I believe it was two thicknesses of 2 inch, like a 2x12 it was shaped out of. So there would have been a 4x12 up there to absorb force of a direct hit.
Interesting.
The bottom of the boat had the slope up quite a bit to get to match it, but it did. So that blunt nose probably wasn't used that much. Thank heavens. It would have been a real jar for a boat that heavy to ram an immovable object.
I'll tell you another story later once we're done about that. But this is, so when you saw the boat and you saw it being built with that 4x12 up front and the double floor on the bottom, it had bulkheads that divided it up into sections.
Yeah.
Did you get a sense that it was a frail boat or a sturdy boat? How would you classify that? What do you think? I mean, because you're not a professional boat builder, but as a young man.
I had already built my first kayak. And I
really?
Built it.
Oh, now that's a whole nother story I want to find out about.
I had built it before I was 12.
What kind of kayak?
Well, my dad was up in the Yukon, and he wrote me a letter on birch bark, and he said, "This is what the Eskimos made their kayaks out of." And I thought, "No, they didn't make them out of birch bark. The Indians did." But anyway, I decided to make a kayak because there was a stream, the river, at least in the springtime. And I had it completed. I had built it just like a little Willows model airplane.
So this would be like a fold boat with a stick structure on the inside?
Well, it was 10 feet long.
Yep.
And it was probably 30 inches wide. And it had maybe 12 inch depth from the top to the bottom. And I had no idea what I was doing, except an idea, and I faced the bottom with tempered masonite.
Oh.
Which is impervious to water.
Yes, for a while, until it gets wet.
Well, it's impervious to water. You don't see it anymore. It's like Bakelite almost.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It had a blunt bow and stern.
Okay.
And I just left a 2-foot by 2-foot opening in the very center of it to sit in, and you had to sit in it Indian style.
So now the true Inuit kayak has a skirt that keeps water out if you happen to roll over and come back up again. Did
never
you
never happened on any of ours?
I see.
To the extent that once I was chasing my son down the river. I went through a column of water that came up over and fell right in on my lap, straight off the mountains. And I keep the boat downstream and
don't get any water in the boat. Okay, all right. I got well. But, that's interesting because this would have been in 1940. So that's 43, 44. To make sure if you're 12-ish, somewhere in there.
Probably 42 would be a good shot starting.
Okay, that's really neat. So when you saw Hudson's building a boat, were you like, well, I got this down already.
I was interested in it.
Okay.
And but it was much bigger than I would have done.
Meaning you thought it was overbuilt, the Esmeralda 2?
I was impressed with the thickness of the bottom. It was important that it withstand shock.
Okay, so what you're saying is it sounds like it was pretty strong.
It was about as strong as you would plan to make a boat.
Okay.
And seeing the pictures of it when they turned it loose, it did suffer some damage, but not on the bottom. It was up on the upper side.
So did you see that film when they threw the ropes?
I have seen the film, but only when I was in high school.
Okay.
And I remember in the film, the camera pans off on the side of the river, and you see a sand spit that's pretty big. And so they pulled over on the sand spit, and before they landed, you could see some writing up on the wall. And they landed the boat, and there was a narrow ledge going up to a rock platform. It was probably 10, 12 feet off the water, off the high water, because they only went through on high water.
That's right.
So the camera was in front of the climber. The climber went up, and the camera cleared the deck, and here was, you were looking straight at a skeleton, a human skeleton, complete. And so it pictured that, and it pictured the writing on the wall. Mm. I don't remember who it was and the dates that he put in there. But they left it there, and I understand since then it's gone to UCLA.
I wonder which skeleton that was. It could have been the South Canyon skeleton, but I digress, and we can...
Yeah.
So let me back up a minute.
Yeah.
So did you talk with Ed Senior at all about what he was doing, and did he say, hey Ed, let's just sit down, I want to tell you what we're doing back here. Did you get a chance to help? Did you put, there were like 7,000 screws in that boat.
No, I didn't really talk with Ed Senior that much. We were bodybuilding at the time, chasing each other around the hills. And but I knew who he was, and I did go to, he showed film at our church one time in the fellowship hall. And Ed Senior got in, because of his recording of his trips, he was inducted into the International Explorers Club. And he went to one meeting of it. This must have been 1950, maybe 49-50 school year. And Hillary had just climbed Everest. Admiral Byrd was still alive. I'm not sure if he was there or not. But they had just found a baby mastodon quick frozen in the Siberian Arctic. And this was a little unusual at the time. It was quick frozen so fast, and this was related to us by Ed Senior. It was quick frozen so fast that it had been eating in a field of clover. And there was clover in its mouth. And so whatever it was, it happened extremely fast.
Mm.
And because it was identifiable as clover.
Yeah.
And they served it at the International Explorers Club in Waldorf Astoria, New York.
They served up the mastodon meat.
Yes.
Oh my heavens.
And since hearing that, I've always sort of kept an eye open for any of their menus. And they are unusual. But I was surprised that, I don't know if he had the Esmeralda 2 in there once or twice in the Colorado River once or twice. I thought, and I'm of the mind, it's twice.
Well, in 1948, they attempted an uprun. And I don't know if Ed Jr. talked with you about that. They went out to Lake Mead with Otis Marston and Willie Taylor, and they attempted to go up the Colorado River in 1948, and they got up to River Mile 220. So if roughly the math, not quite right, but 280, so they came up 60 miles.
Yeah.
And they couldn't climb 217 mile rapid. They okay. And Marston tried and tried, and he was out in the middle of the river trying to power up and uh-huh. just couldn't climb this rapid.
Yeah.
Did they talk about that in 48? Did Ed mention
well,
that at all?
The thing I remember them saying was in coming down the river, and he had been all the way down to the, all the way down, not in the Esmeralda, but in
well, the Esmeralda
anything
won.
That would float, they'd go down in.
Yeah.
But the Esmeralda, at least on one trip, they put in at Expedition Isle up on the Green River, and they'd come down and they would go through a rapid and they would turn around and come back up it and log it.
As an uprun.
Yeah, so that they would have a memory of it and maybe pictures of it, so that they, with the, and they did, then they'd go down to the next one, they'd turn around, come back, and then go down all the way through Cataract Canyon, which of course isn't there now, it's buried.
Right.
But they always tried and kept notes and pictures of how they could come back up. That was their hope, was to put into Lake Mead and go all the way up.
That was the plan. In 1948, they were figuring out where they were going to get gas in Moab.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was amazed.
So it was. In fact, Ed Jr. and I talked about it quite a bit. And I was in a used bookstore. And I was looking at the book, and here's Writing of the Long Canyon of the Grand Canyon, and I laughed and I grabbed it out, and actually I was really surprised that it's a 1953 book. I thought it was an old story. It was written about Teddy Roosevelt's time, and that's what it was. That's where it was placed. But I got a kick out of that.
Yeah. So did you keep boating? Did you keep kayaking then?
When my son got in kayaking, in scouts, there was a man that we enjoyed. They were close, my son and his sons were close friends, school kid friends. And we would go places with the scout troop that was exciting, to say the least. And so they've got to have a kayak. And so we would build one, and then he says, no, they all have to have them. And so I made a mold-ish. I was in an area that I wasn't familiar with, but I made a mold.
And by this time, we're talking fiberglass.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was a man that says, I can get you a bolt, a roll of batting, a roll of fabric, and a 55-gallon drum of resin.
My.
And boom, 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 boom. They were all delivered. And we got the mold. It was a two-piece mold. The bottom was one, and the top was another. And we had some colors that they could, and each of the boys made their own kayak. And now that is...
What year was this?
72, 73?
No, okay. It was like 1968,
69. Okay, 68, 69.
Might have been 68, I think 69.
And then we would bolt them together with screws. and nuts on the inside. Machine screws.
The top and bottom halves?
Yes.
And then would you glass that seam in?
No, we didn't even do that. And we took them up to, up above this lake on a major river that comes out of this.
Went to the Colorado River first. We went to the Colorado River first.
Oh, no, not with those.
Yeah.
Okay, we took, anyway, it was, one of the fathers got in it. The boys had to do their own work on that, and that was fun.
Did they make their own paddles? How'd you get paddles?
Yeah, it was, the paddle was just a pole, an inch and a half rod with of wood with a plywood paddle.
Bolted on the ends, yeah.
And but we took them to Colorado River, and we found that they made 13, and it cost them $30 a piece.
That's pretty good.
But the other thing is, and we learned it as soon as we got in there, you have to work like the devil to go downstream, because the water goes down, but the air comes up.
So it was windy.
And the kayaks are not fastened to the water. If you want to go downstream in a kayak, then get a sea anchor.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they had to fight to go 7 miles, which was our first stop, and they were exhausted by the time they got through.
Bet.
Yeah.
Let's go back now to Paso Robles and the Esmeralda 2, sitting under it was under a little shed, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah. Next to the garage, and a chicken coop coming off of the shed, coming off of it.
So what's the connection with Ed Sr. and chickens?
Oh, well, the economy wasn't the greatest coming out of the war. He had to develop a whole new economy. And so Ed Sr. had bought the Clark Drugs store, and eventually he had the opportunity. I think there was three men involved, and they had a chicken ranch in Paso Robles that was right below Reservoir Hill. It brings up some laughs, but there was also chicken ranches that he was partners with in the Central Valley, I believe. I never saw them, but I just, but the one in Paso Robles, it had a pretty good sized chicken barn shed right below the road that goes up to Reservoir Hill. And we used to kid, and so there he probably had 2,000 or 3,000 chickens in there, you know, because they were a supply for a larger area. And boys will be boys. We'd get in the car and we'd go up Reservoir Hill, go around, there'd be the chicken shed down there. Hey, let's throw rocks on the chicken shed. It was a metal roof. No. So we didn't do it, but we always kidded about it. Ed would get a little upset.
I just learned that going through the Marston material that Ed made, he did very well with the chicken ranching.
I imagine he did, because there were, Tyson has done extremely well.
There you go.
Tyson's Corners, I assume. Right. It's a family.
Yeah, there you go. So. Otis Marston spent a considerable amount of time trying to figure out Ed Hudson and how would a druggist into chickens build such an incredible boat that would be the first motorboat to go through Grand Canyon. And Marston was like, you know, like, and then go in the Explorers Club where they're going to eat some mammoth, and Hillary had just climbed the Everest. And so Marston was like, what was it about Ed Hudson that brought him above and beyond and into the explorer's realm?
You know, the thing I remember most as a description about that activity, they were river rats. Yeah. Now, Ed had been, he may have been a druggist out in the town right by the river, on Route 66.
Yuma?
Huh?
Yuma?
No. Up. If you were going to Flagstaff,
like
you'd go
Needles?
Right through it.
The Needles?
Needles, yeah. Uh-huh. I think at a point they had been in Needles and involved in drug stores there. Before he came to Paso Robles, he was down in not Yucaipa.
But another town.
Yeah,
another town. He mentioned that too, that he would set up a drugstore, get it up, get it going, and then sell it. And then set up another one. And he had done fairly well with that.
Yeah. And probably in that activity, you wear yourself out to an extent. And he needed some downtime. And he must have loved the water. And he and a few buddies would go down the river as far as they could go. Start at Needles, say. If they started Needles, there was a dam they had to go around to get down. So they'd go down to the dam, they'd come back. But then they'd go below Needles and go on down, or
right.
Below the dam.
He had made it all the way to Yuma from Hoover Dam before he started playing with Esmeralda 2 on Lake Mead going up.
Right.
And then ran up to Lee's Ferry and came down. Right. And eventually he connected, as you say, he connected up above Moab.
Yeah.
To the Sea of Cortez. He went all the way out to the Sea of Cortez.
I don't know that the Colorado River has always made it through. There may have been dry areas, dry times when it didn't make it through. But there's a story of history that a Spanish galleon came up the Sea of Cortez and up the Colorado River, and it's somewhere in the desert, it's there. And you don't hear it a lot, but every once in a while you hear about it.
Well, the Coronado Expedition had three galleons going up the Pacific coast. I assume that the North America was a simple pyramid, and the land expedition was going to go up to the top of the pyramid, and the sea expedition was going to come along, and they would resupply where they met.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it doesn't quite work that way. So Alarcón came up into the Sea of Cortez, and actually they got out a boat off of their galleon, and the Native Americans helped tow that boat up toward Yuma, where they buried some supplies in the ground, and then the Coronado expedition, Melchor Diaz, actually was in Yuma, found this tree that said dig here.
Oh.
And so he got some of the resupply stuff, but they missed each other by months and they never met. So I wonder if that's that story.
Is that tree still there? You don't know.
That's a good question.
Yeah. No.
Well, so it's interesting. You're making me think. You said, well, Ed was a river rat.
That's right. That
and he was. He was definitely interested not only in oar-powered boats, but then in motor-powered boats and what a motor boat could do. And he was willing to sink a good amount of finances into this.
Yeah.
I mean, you built your own kayak, you had to scrounge material or try to put some money into it to make it work. And he, in 48, after that failed uprun, he dropped the Gray Marine motor and swapped it out and put in a bigger one.
Yeah.
Did you see any of that stuff happen? Did you see the completed boat head out on the trailer? And
I'm thinking the first engine he had in it would have been a six-cylinder Gray Marine.
was a Grand Marine, that's right, and six-cylinder, it was out 75 horsepower unit, and he doubled that horsepower to 120 or 125 with a bigger Grand Marine, which was also, a straight six, a flathead six.
Yeah. Now, which one I saw, I don't know. Although, I saw it before it had ever been in the water.
Okay. And so that might have been the smaller unit.
It was probably a smaller one.
So did you see the unit out?
And you know, I don't remember the size of propeller he would have put on it.
Have you been to see the boat at the south rim of Grand Canyon?
No.
Because it is still there.
It's still there.
And you might like to go see it.
I think I saw Powell's boat once, but I was quite young when I saw it.
Well, they have the Powell boat's only a piece about this big. The one and only Powell boat burned in a fire in 1931 at Lee's Ferry. And it was kind of silted in. The water had come in and silted in around it. And the only bit that survived was this bit that was protected by
it. Yeah.
But there's a story here.
Well, what I saw would have been in 45 or for either 45 or 46 when I went on a tour of the Southwest Parks after the war with the Boy Scouts, and the Grand Canyon was one of the stops. And of course it would have Powell's information there at least. And,
so that burnt bit of that boat was there, but they also, by that time, they had some historic boats at the South Rim. Maybe the Caltech boats from 37, or they had the USGS boats from 23.
The only thing I remember was Powell's.
Okay.
And information about Powell.
Hmm. Okay.
And that was at the South Rim.
At the South Rim, yeah. Yeah.
Did Ed go with you?
I remember. Yeah, did Ed go with you on that trip?
No.
Okay.
No, he didn't. He may have. No, he didn't.
Okay.
I remember his last time that Ed Jr. went. His mother was left up on the South Rim, and as I was told, she decided she felt something was wrong, and she hired a helicopter, and they went looking, and they found it. And there's a picture that I've seen of on the sand spit that helped. And I think it was HELP. I don't think it was SOS.
It's SOS.
Yeah. Okay. And they were standing by it. Now, they would have lifted her out and gone single pilot down to but and the one helicopter crashed. And I think there was a broken shoulder in that, but I'm not sure. You know that. So another helicopter came and got him out. And
so did Ed tell you that story then? That
yeah,
after
that would have been.
That
yeah.
would have been great to hear that.
Yeah, they turned the boat loose, and as soon as they got out, they gave it to the park department because it. They didn't want it to go to private property, as they wanted, and they weren't going to be able to get it. It was salvage. And so then there was a bit of a struggle because someone did find it and didn't attempt to, but it was the Parks Department already, and they got it. Ed and I, he tried to talk me into spending about a week or two over the edge of the cliff of the Grand Canyon and hike along it. And that never developed. It would have been a tiring thing and probably exciting, and maybe it would have been very educational in a lot of ways.
What year would that have been?
Probably 48, 49 school year as a junior. I don't think it was, because now I'm not sure when Ed Jr. went. I know he went in the summer of the senior year, or spring of the senior year. Did he go in the spring summer of our junior year also, which would have been 48, 9? I'm just not sure. It never developed. It would have been an interesting thing, but fraught with problems.
Well, you would have been very early on and one of the very first explorers of the canyon by foot. Though, Bass had done that. Yeah. And of course, the First Nation people were all over the canyon for many years before we showed up. So
Ed Jr., my classmate, they stopped and they hiked up to Rainbow Bridge National Monument, and he signed on the book. I see there's a picture of another man signing on the book or displaying the book.
Yeah.
And Ed Jr. signed on in the, I'm going to say, the low 100s. Well, now you can almost drive your car to it. It's a very short, or drive your boat to it.
Mm.
And,
did you didn't get a chance to run Glen Canyon?
No.
The dam came in? No, okay.
But they had in their moving pictures, he had a tripod on the deck of his boat, and he had I guess it was a 16mm camera. And that would be a wild ride in a camera.
The first GoPros.
Yeah. But he had miles of film on it, and including Cataract Canyon. And probably there's not a lot of film individuals of a motion picture, because you're probably trying to save yourself.
That's right, that's right.
In that instance, whereas the camera's up there bouncing along, and it might be bouncing so radically that it'd be hard to define what you're looking at.
It can be problematic, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you meet Willie Taylor at all?
No, I knew the name Martis Austin. I still remember it because Ed Jr. spoke of him so much, so there was a close association there. And I understood that Esmeralda 2 was designed in San Francisco by a marine architect. Now, whether that was applied to Otis Marston, I don't know. I don't know what Otis Marston did, aside from he was a river rat, and he took a Chris Craft through there.
Well, it's interesting because Ed thought long and hard about how to make a boat that he thought was strong enough to go up Grand Canyon. He was thinking and pondering and pondering, and sent his concepts to this award-winning naval architect who came up with this Higgins-type inverted V-bottom, protect the propeller with a big skeg kind of thing. Which did amazingly well.
Yeah.
So Marston kind of came into that, and for the second trip just got a stock Chris Craft off the shelf in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And Ed didn't think it would stand a chance.
A thought came to mind. Yeah. I've lost it now. I met a man who came from Nebraska during the war and worked for a boat builder in Long Beach that built PT boats.
Really?
Yes. There are two places they were built, and they were slightly different.
Hmm.
Probably the the hulls were virtually identical. The PT boats were made of mahogany and oak, the oak for strength and mahogany for lightness, I guess. Mm. And they had a frame every 6 inches. The Esmeralda II did not have it that often.
Right.
And the if they were sheathed with a quarter-inch mahogany, diagonal sheeting, both sides with copper rivets at every single bearing. And then they smoothed all that out, and that was, they were flush jointed. They smoothed all that out, painted it with glue, put linen on it, painted it with glue, and they started going the other way with quarter inch mahogany. This is on the bottom with two more copper rivets. At each bearing.
Hmm.
And the side, he didn't tell me about the side that much, but that meant the bottom was really strong.
Right.
And he said the crew would have it for a week and get used to it and run it in some, and then the test pilot would get on it and they'd take it out and they would run the boat all day at different speeds. And the test pilot pretty well knew what it was going to do.
Hmm.
And it had to do 60 knots. And, a big boat doing
That's
60
fast.
Knots in a flying mile in Long Beach Harbor.
Wow.
And he would come in through the flying mile wide open. And as soon as he was out of it, he would pop it from full forward into full reverse, and the boat would just, and when the water was lapping at his feet, he would pop into full forward and bring it back. That's about all, but it was all, that was boat building of then.
So they dropped the Esmeralda into Morro Bay.
I understand that, but I didn't know at the time, I don't think.
Okay, and so you didn't see that, you weren't there?
No, I wasn't there.
After the 1949 downrun, did Ed Jr. talk with you about it? Was he happy? Did he talk about the adventure at all?
Oh, yeah. Basically, you hang on for all your life.
Is that what he said?
Probably.
Uh-huh.
Ed wasn't verbose. He wasn't a real super talkative guy.
Mm.
But a lot of their motion pictures related a lot of the story. He was a school kid at the time, and I was too, and so we were more interested in what we were doing at the time. But it was a great adventure for him, especially with his father.
Yeah,
yeah. I like that picture that Gregory pulled up off the computer. I hadn't seen it, but I recognized which one was Ed and which one was Ed Jr.
Nice. Yeah. Did Ed Jr. whistle a lot?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Why? Not that I remember.
Okay. Because there's just a funny story in here that Ed Jr. whistled the same tune over and over and over again. And Willie Taylor was going nuts.
Well,
and sanity was restored when Willie took Ed aside and taught him a new tune.
I would fully accept that.
Okay.
It might be just something I don't remember particularly about him, but whistling, you won't stutter.
Right. And that's a very fascinating point.
Yeah.
Yeah. The King's Speech is.
And it, but it causes you a constancy of thought.
Yes. Yeah, which is very, very neat. So did you stay friends with Ed then as you guys went through college and then on into life?
Well, we were in the National Guard together also.
We were.
But when he transferred to...
Hang on a second.
Ask him about that.
All right. I'm asking you about that.
Oh.
When did you join?
I joined October 19th, 1949. And we were a tank company. We had the old Sherman tanks of World War II.
So you and Ed together went in? Because he was in ROTC, wasn't he?
No, he was
in
could have been, but we never spoke of that.
Okay, all right.
He might have gone to ROTC when he went to UCLA rather than the National Guard. He went in the Army after graduation.
Okay.
And Ed was in the Army working for the Air Force, I think I have this straight, on a Navy base in Iceland.
Wow.
Doing mapping. Wow. I may have the last, he was in the Army.
Okay.
But all three services were involved.
Wow. And then, but there's a story here.
High school.
Oh. High school.
We used to take the tanks down to the river because the river was dry, and we would just practice driving, and then we'd come back up and clean them up and service them.
This is in the winter of 1949, spring
during
of 1950?
During the year when we weren't at camp.
Okay.
But at camp, if we were out driving, we all had to learn how to drive them and shoot them. And someone would say, "Oh, there goes a jackrabbit." And we would chase jackrabbits.
In a tank?
In a tank. And they would do very well.
Because they can weave and dodge, and you would be like weaving it.
They zigzag so they can see.
Hmm.
But they zigzag in a straight line, and then they're exhausted, they get in a bush. And when you're 10 feet from the bush, they go that way. And then you have to gear the thing
turn
around and take off chasing them again. And so it was a real exercise in driving and visual accumulation.
What a great idea. go get rabbits.
But it was fun. And the thing was, the high school kids at that time were all into automotive.
Hmm.
And the M4 tank had a Ford V8 in it that was dual overhead cam, dual ignition, dual exhaust, and it was made. The original was designed to be a bomber, which didn't work.
Hmm.
So they cut it down to 8. But it was all gear driven. So, and dual ignition, if you found one today and could get electric power to it, it would start.
Wow, yeah. Well, that's what the Esmeralda with the Gray Marine up at the South Rim of Grand Canyon,
yeah.
A little bit of gasoline, turn it over, it'd fire up.
Yeah.
So,
it wasn't structural damage that lost the Esmeralda. It was seal wear.
Head gasket.
On the drive shaft. They could not correct it.
You know, there's a great recounting of the events here, which is pretty neat, about how it broke and how it was fixed. Frank Wright came along on the next trip, and they found the boat up high and dry. The river had dropped. The boat was dry docked up on some rocks. And they started it right up, and it ran rough, but it ran. And they turned it off, and they drug it down to the river. It wasn't running real good. And Frank was like, well, if we can't fix it tonight, we're just going to leave it. They ended up pulling off the head. They just unbolted it and lifted it off.
Uh-huh.
And that's where he saw that one of the head gasket gets pretty thin between the cylinders, and that had blown off there. So he cut some gasket material and set it in there, keyed it in, and it ran great.
Huh.
And that's how they got it out.
So
that it's an interesting story.
I was left with the impression that the seal would not stop the water from coming into the engine compartment.
Well, they had at times trouble with that, but they figured it out.
Okay.
So they tightened it up and got it so it wasn't.
I haven't read this yet.
Yeah. No, they got that figured out.
Yeah. Okay.
So it was pretty good. But, it's an interesting.
I would think they had extra drive shafts with them.
I believe that they did. I know they had various extra parts.
Yeah.
But this was a little above and beyond their ability.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'll find out.
Ed got married and had a son.
Yes. Ed passed away. I had never met Ed in his post-education years.
So you guys didn't visit again after college?
I'm trying to think. He must. I probably saw him at one of our. At one of our class reunions. That's for a very short time. I knew he was living in up the 5 freeway in.
Up there.
Valencia? Was it Valencia or College of the
Game? Valencia area.
Yeah.
I got word that he died, and there was a ceremony at the cemetery for him. And that was the first time I met his son, who was A&E for American Airlines in Germany. And so he ran a small station there and probably called in whatever he needed to get the airplanes back in the air. And he did the service for his father. And it was absolutely magnificent.
Wow.
I became a Christian in midlife, and this boy, this young man, actually he had mature daughters with him that were magnificent ladies. I don't remember his name, but he did the service, and he offered the gospel to those that heard.
Nice.
And I said, now that is rare. It was, and I told him so. It was beautiful.
Nice.
Ed had a nice home that there was a reception at afterwards, and so I was able to talk a little with them.
Mm.
Yeah. And so that was great for me.
Nice.
All my high school years, I knew something of it, but nothing of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's the way it went.
Sure.
And it was much, much later that I came to that knowledge.
Nice.
Of Christ and him in my life.
Ed was very helpful when he knew we were getting interested in this story to look over the material that we had written about those river trips, 1949 and 1950.
Yeah.
And he said, you've kind of left out Willie Taylor, and you need to go back and rethink this. And So I said, well, we're going to be at the Huntington. I'm doing this research. I'd love to come visit. And so we went up, and he showed us films and just basically talked to me about Willie and how amazing he was, because I had not understood. Willie Taylor was one of the people on those river trips in 1949, 1950.
Okay, yeah.
And so it was very helpful to me, very magnanimous, very generous, just taught me quite a bit.
And you were talking with?
With Ed Jr.
Oh, you were talking with Ed Jr. A few years ago.
We actually went to the house and visited with him, and I called him on the phone a number of times and emailed a little bit back and forth, and then he passed away, and I'm like, wait.
stop. Back up the clock.
yeah. But then his son got in touch out of the blue, and we shared a little bit back and forth, so it was very nice.
I don't know where Ed's wife came from. I never met her.
I never met her, and I believe she had passed away by the time, or that they had been separated, I'm not sure, by the time we went and visited at the house.
Uh-huh.
I'm
not going to guess at what happened.
Not sure. Yeah. But just a wonderful man, and just made me think about, you know, his father, and Marston has this saying, just, I can't understand how a druggist from Paso Robles into Chickens can put this boat together and go down through Grand Canyon.
My father was in construction, and he tried contracting, and it wasn't a big enough area.
Mm.
That's why he was wound up in. He built a Japanese internment camp up in Tule Lake. Then he went up to White Horse for a 3-inch oil line.
Wow. So traveling then for construction.
Yeah, he was up there for about a year, I guess. Okay. Then he went out to Attu for a Air Force base.
Wow.
Navy Air Force. It was joint. And says the only place in the world that he knew that you could spit at the ground and get it back in your face.
Oh.
But it's they needed it. They had, after we got it back from the Japs, we used it extensively for interdiction in Japan.
Yeah. Very fun.
In fact, one of the brother-in-laws. My wife's brother-in-law, I call him brother-in-law, he flew Navy bombers from there in the summertime. In the winter, they were at on Puget Sound, a naval base there, but in summer they'd go out to Attu.
Wow.
And they would fly one plane at a time to the North Island of Japan and drop and bomb an Air Force base that was there. Of the planes they sent, one plane out and back, all by himself. They lost 80% of the squadron. They were flying radio silence, so there's no communication. But he was an engineer from UCLA and geologist also, so he knew surveying and he knew celestial surveying, even though he had a navigator with him, so he could visually check.
Could figure out.
Look
at the stars and figure out his direction.
Yeah. So that was, those were, it was exciting times living in those, growing up in those years.
Is there anything else that you would like to mention about Ed that I haven't captured?
I believe he was probably enjoyed his work. I think most of his work was local. I'm not sure what exactly it was. It was in the geology field. The main geology here would be oil. his buddy that was down there, classmate at the same time, and my classmate also, he wound up operating a gold mine in New Guinea.
My.
But they're both gone.
Mm.
And so that's, I think he was, I think Ed was satisfied with what he was doing.
When we visited with him, he seemed quite content and very helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was, I have a picture of me that he took in high school, and it's a good study.
Nice.
Let me put it that way.
Nice.
And I look at it and I said, I'm looking out there, way, way, way out there. And it's taken in a setting where you can do that. And I was trying to see something far ahead.
Nice.
And I think I found it.
Nice.
But it was a good study that he caught.
Mm.
And he did a lot of the photo work in our album, in our
yearbook?
Our yearbook album, yeah.
Nice.
I think he didn't take the little pictures.
No, but just putting it
and
taking pictures of other stuff?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, he did. The advertising pictures, that's part of what we did. And other things, pictures of the school and the other activities. And, but he was, so he enjoyed photography a lot.
Hmm.
And he also developed them himself. And so I imagine he had an enlarger. I don't know that he carried that, I'm sure he did, carried that passion on through life. But I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah.
Well, Ed Shockley and Greg, thank you so very much for a wonderful oral history here. This is the 27th of August, 2018. My name is Tom Martin, and that will conclude this Grand Canyon oral history.
Did Ed continue to travel or do things like that?
Hold that thought here.